Should the reactions of Eastern critics influence Western artists?
It's probably not to our credit in the West that we tend to withhold approval of work until someone in the New York Times Book Review has given it an okay. I think we should probably, by this stage in the game, have more confidence in ourselves than to wait to see how someone in New York or Boston is going to react to the work that we produce out here.
Welcome to The Right Question, a weekly radio program about writing and publishing in the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, and my guest again this week is historian Dan Flores. If you missed part one of our conversation, you can find a link to it at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Flores holds the A.B. Hammond Chair in Western History at the University of Montana, Missoula. He is the author of 8 books and numerous articles published in magazines such as Texas Monthly, The Big Sky Journal, Southwest Art, and High Country News. During this program, we'll continue our conversation about Flores' new book, Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photographing the Northern Rocky Mountain West. When we left off last week, we were talking about depictions of Custer's last stand. The interpretation given to us was that Custer made this heroic last stand.
Yeah.
We have paintings and Native American interpretations that really disagree with that.
The last stand is literally a visual artist creation. We have no historical accounts that portray Custer making a last stand. No one in the 7th Cavalry, of course, survived to be able to leave an account. And the Indians from the very beginning, although they learned eventually not to emphasize this too much, but from the very beginning, when whites asked them about Custer's last stand, they were puzzled. They didn't really know what this question was or what it meant. What people like E.F. Paxson of Missoula here with his famous painting, this astonishingly detailed painting of Custer's last stand, did was to create, basically create a history and create a myth. And really, the National Monument itself, which was long called Custer Battlefield National Monument, was dedicated to that whole proposition that Custer had died this heroic death in a last stand. I mean, whole generations of Americans grew up believing this is what happened. I mean, what we now know is that it almost certainly didn't happen that way, that it's a pure invention, and yet it's been downloaded into our minds. What I tried to do in the chapter on this was to show several American Indian paintings of the Little Bighorn by famous artists like T.C. Cannon, for example, and Fritz Schoelder. I've always loved the Fritz Schoelder painting that opens this particular chapter. It's called Custer and 20,000 Indians. And what Schoelder is attempting to portray here is that this episode in history is really just all about George Armstrong Custer, because the painting, it doesn't show 20,000 Indians. It doesn't show a single Indian. It's just a painting of George Armstrong Custer with raised saber, his foot on a rock, standing there alone in a field in eastern Montana. And the irony of the title, of course, is intended to convey to the audience of that painting that the Indians don't matter in the way America has remembered this particular episode. I mean, it's a fascinating story, and it's one that arouses passions, enormous passions, on both sides.
What's your interpretation in a nutshell of what really happened?
We can't actually know because we don't have an account from the 7th Cavalry side, and the Indians have offered conflicting accounts of it, but probably what happened was that Custer was hit and wounded fairly early in the charge on the village. And whether his men grouped around him, which they probably did, is a different sort of conclusion than having him be standing upright with raised saber as the last man standing, kind of representing the vanguard point of American civilization in the American West, which is how white paintings of this event portrayed him. But, I mean, the actual truth is we simply don't know precisely what happened to him, other than I can say I'm relatively certain that The Last Stand is a fiction.
Although most of the artists and photographers in your book are male, because that's the way it happened, you have some fascinating women. You've already mentioned Evelyn Cameron, and there are others. One story that was just heartbreaking was the story of Fray Dana.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
Yes, Fray Dana, really in some ways compelling figure, beautiful woman, apparently beautiful her entire life. And the photograph, the portrait that's in the book of her when she's in her middle 20s really shows a strikingly beautiful young woman, artist from Indiana. Some question these days about exactly how much she trained under Mary Cassatt, but that has long been the tradition that she was a student of Mary Cassatt's, who was probably the most famous woman painter of the late 19th century. And Fray Dana, as a young woman, met and fell in love with a young man whose family owned a ranch near the Bighorn Mountains, basically straddling the Wyoming-Montana border. His family was a New England family, and so like a lot of these early ranch families, they were educated, they were quite sophisticated in their outlook. But Fray Dana, in some respects, I think, sort of made a bad marriage for herself. She wanted to be famous. She wanted to be a famous artist. And she knew that in order to do so, she needed to go to Europe regularly. She needed to stay in touch with the art scene in the East, particularly in New York. And Edwin, as one could imagine quite easily, wanted her to stay in Wyoming on the ranch. And so she starts out as a young woman full of promise and energy and very obvious talent, painting lovely pieces for about 8 or 10 years. And then starting in about 1905, she basically stops painting. And the reason that she gives in her diaries, I quote her diaries rather extensively in that particular chapter, is that Edwin struggles against her every time she tries to go back east and sort of rejuvenate her artistic juices. And so she can't fight him, she says. She's just going to give up. And so she becomes a ranch wife and rails against it for years, having to entertain people who she says are not interesting, who are boring. She has to feed them and clean up their slops. I mean, that's a direct quote from her journals. And so she has a life in the West that really kind of embitters her. And one of the things I tried to do, because I do this running comparison between the Northern Rockies and the Southwest in this book, is to compare her to a contemporary of hers, Georgia O'Keeffe, who also is married, but who moves to New Mexico despite her husband's wishes. Alfred Stieglitz did not want her to go, but nonetheless, she moved to New Mexico and bought a house where she would go and spend summers outside Santa Fe, and whose reaction to the West, and particularly to the arid West, is so strikingly different from Fray Dana's. I mean, I counterpoise these quotes where Georgia O'Keeffe will be writing her friends back east and will say, you know, I weigh 118 every day is like the sound of a bell in my mind. You wouldn't believe how beautiful the country is. I can't describe to you how incredible what I see out my window is. And meanwhile, up on the Montana Wyoming border, Fray Dana, in those same years, is describing how ugly the alkali and the sagebrush and the jackrabbits and the hard light all are. I mean, it's this sort of striking kind of difference between two very talented women artists of the same generation who end up about 1,000 miles apart in the West and who end up having completely different experiences.
There's a lot of comparing and traveling back and forth between East and West in your essays. In your essay about Ansel Adams, you write, "The East never quite got Ansel Adams and his whole romantic, spiritual Western nature thing. To some extent, the East still does not get him." Why do you say that?
Well, I think except for his contacts in the Museum of Modern Art, and he did certainly have some one-man shows there, critics, by and large, in the East didn't understand an art, in Ansel Adams' case, of course, it was a photographic art, that excluded people. One of the things that an art critic said about Ansel Adams when he finally did show or exhibit a few portraits that he had shot, this one critic in the New York Times said, "One photograph of Georgia O'Keeffe's face is worth all the landscapes that Ansel Adams has ever shot in the Yosemite Valley." Well, of course, most of us don't feel that way at all. I mean, his portrait of Georgia O'Keeffe is marvelous, perfectly happy to have it, but those stunning photographs, the Snake River overlook in the Tetons, for example, or Lake McDonnell and Glacier, let alone the photographs of Yosemite and Half Dome or the moon coming up over Hernandez, New Mexico, those things are going to live as great classics of Western visual art. Whereas the Georgia O'Keeffe portrait, I mean, it basically takes an expert on Ansel Adams to even know that that thing exists. But I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, Easterners are maybe a little uncomfortable with a focus on nature and the grandeur of nature. They loved Richard Avedon's photographic take on the West in the 1980s, which, of course, were these hard, sharply focused black and white photographs of all these down-and-out types, working-class, down-and-out people, circus carnies and prostitutes and so forth all over the West. That book got great reviews, but Ansel Adams really never managed to win over his Eastern critics with work that I think is probably going to be classics for all time.
A lot of the art that was created in this time period is sold to the Great Northern Railway to make people get on trains and ride out here and pay
Absolutely.
Them. So Lewis Hill is almost an art patron.
He is an art patron, you know, and whatever you can say about Louis Hill, he does managed to lure to Montana, to Glacier Park specifically, a terrific range of primarily painters, but sometimes photographers as well. I mean, he sets them a kind of a businessman's task, which is they have to produce this art that he can convert into posters and put on dining tables, on menus, and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, he does bring out some really outstanding people. And I think the person who I'm most impressed by as a kind of a Louis Hill acolyte and protege in Glacier is Maynard Dixon. Maynard Dixon's just extraordinary painting, Home of the Blackfeet, is on the cover of the book. But Louis Hill managed to get Maynard Dixon to Glacier after Maynard Dixon had tried getting into Montana two or three times with varying degrees of success. But finally, in 1914, he got out, did a bunch of terrific pieces. And, I mean, there, again, is a kind of a fascinating and almost tragic story. He did at least 10 big oils for Louis Hill that have completely disappeared off the face of the earth. He shipped them from San Francisco once he was done with them to Minneapolis. They apparently arrived in Minneapolis, but from Minneapolis on the way out to Glacier, they disappeared. And since Maynard Dixon's are these days, large Maynard Dixon oils are bringing well over $1 million, someone one of these days is going to find those things. I hope they're not in a ditch along the railroad somewhere. But if they ever are found, that's going to be an astonishing rediscovery of some vanished American art.
Ooh, treasure hunt.
That's a treasure hunt for sure.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with historian Dan Flores. Right after a short break, we'll find out where the idea of North America as a Mother Earth deity came from, and we'll hear about the art of Emily Carr. In your essay about Emily Carr, you mention a fairly recent book by another historian named Sam Gill, in which he, quote, demolishes the widely held idea that Indian religions harbored a Mother Earth deity, but also show how the notion of an Earth Mother emerged from the 16th and 17th century European images of America as a mysterious and pliant female Indian.
Yeah.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Isn't that intriguing? Because we all just assume as, a matter of deeply held belief that Indians had a Mother Earth and a Father Sky. I mean, we sort of have set those up without ever questioning them. That Sam Gill book, I will say, is not without some controversy as a book, but it is... to my mind and the mind of a lot of other historians with whom I've discussed it, it's pretty compelling and convincing that the idea of the Mother Earth came from European notions of the North American continent. And like so many elements that get internalized by Native people, all kinds of things, for example, having to do with religion, with Christianity, end up being internalized by various Native groups when they're exposed to missionaries. I mean, they just sort of install into their belief system these various notions that resonate for them and sound fairly familiar to them. And so Sam Gill's argument is that, in fact, he even tracks the earliest use of the Mother Earth imagery by Native people, and it's always by people, by Indians, who are considerably acculturated already. They're the ones who pick it up, and his argument is that they've picked it up from the Europeans and sort of embedded into their own culture, and it then becomes a very widespread notion. And Euro-Americans, then come to see it as an idea that springs from the Native mind itself.
So this came over with missionaries to the Indians?
Well, it probably came over with the colonizers, the settlers primarily, because, I mean, Gill makes no bones about it. The idea of North America as a female, as this pliant, receptive female, was very current in the literature of the 16 and 17 and even 1800s in Europe. I mean, this was one of the things that immigration companies used to lure settlers to America, is that it's this landscape that is far less harsh than Europe is. It's got an abundance of natural resources. It's like this fecund mother figure that is going to nurse you through your early years as a settler because it's just so lavish and so rich. And so the idea is that Europeans bring that notion over in their conversations with Native people. The Native people pick it up and they embed it into their own cultural ideas.
Well, if we look at it that way, then much of the history of the West and the art of the West begins to make sense, because the predominant culture was male-oriented and male-dominated.
Indeed. Yeah, there's a historian named Annette Kolodny who has fleshed this out pretty elaborately in a couple of books, one of which is suggestively titled, she calls it, The Lay of the Land. That's essentially a book that argues very much for a kind of a male perspective on this pliant, receptive landscape that's awaiting the settlers in the West. And so, I mean, as you know from looking at this chapter on Emily Carr, I was kind of fascinated by the fact that Emily Carr had absorbed this idea of the Earth Mother, and that much of her art, especially in the 1930s and 1940s, not only her art, but I mean, she was a writer as well and wrote several prize-winning books. And she basically sees herself as kind of channeling Mother Earth of the Canadian Rockies and the American Northern Rockies into her art, and tries to capture what she believes is the sort of rhythm and the feel of this vibrating Mother Earth beneath the ground. And I mean, some of that, she's a modernist, of course, and is doing abstract art, but some of the rhythms in the art that's reproduced in the book, I think, really strikingly kind of captures what she thought she was doing with this Mother Earth energy.
The photograph of her with all the cats,
yeah,
kind of captures,
and a monkey.
Yeah. Captures what she was all about.
Yeah, she never married, and as far as we're able to tell, I mean, Emily Carr never had a boyfriend or a lover, and so it's maybe not entirely something that you wouldn't suspect when you see a photograph of her completely surrounded by cats and monkeys and other animals. I mean, as someone who was childless and who did not have a significant other in her own species, she tended to lavish love and attention on animals, and she had lots of them.
Well, in going back to where we started with the all of the writers who have come here, maybe they've come here to write out the kinks in these myths that are inconsistent and are not true and are still kind of plaguing us in some of the portrayals that we get that go back east and go to Europe. We've still got movies and books that are portraying us as something we're not. So maybe if we have all of Western Montana, all of Eastern Montana, full of writers interpreting what's going on here today, will finally be understood, and those critics in the East will not be able to reign over us anymore.
I would love to see that happen. I mean, you know, I'm not a painter myself. I'm a writer, and so what I'm interested in seeing is exactly that happening, as Bill Kittredge wrote a decade or more ago. What we need are new stories that help us understand more accurately who we are. I think that's a profound and important way, very important way to put the matter. We need new stories. And I think in some respects, what I was trying to do with Visions of the Big Sky in the 25 chapters in this book was to give us a bunch of new stories. We've thought of the region in part because of Charlie Russell, I believe, as kind of a man's world of big wilderness and big animals up in the northern Rockies. But by focusing on all these women artists and photographers, and almost a third of the painters and photographers in this book are women, I was trying to, I think, give us a way of seeing the place through new eyes. And it's those new stories that the writers are spinning all around us all the time.
Dan Flores divides his time between the Bitterroot Valley of western Montana and the Galisteo River Valley outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can find more information about him and his books at therightquestion.blogspot.com.
The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, enriching intellectual, cultural, and civic life for all Montanans, and by Montana's Cultural Trust. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio. Sheree Newman, producer, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. Special thanks to Lisa Simon, David Moore, Barbara Thoreau, and Kim Anderson. The music in this program was written and performed by Aaron Minnick and John Floridis. Look for more information about regional authors, send comments, and listen to this program again at therightquestion.blogspot.com. We're also on Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm Will Tilton, inviting you to tune in again next time for The Right Question.